Ladies and gentlemen, everyone has had an opportunity this afternoon to already introduce Father Martin, so they asked me if I would reintroduce him. And it's with great pleasure that I do. Several months ago, I saw the now famous Chalk Talk. For those of you who have not seen it, I'm sure that after today, you will seek it out and view what I consider to be the finest piece of educational material in the field of alcoholism that has ever been produced. I'm not alone in this thought, and it is probably one of the most sought after, most valuable films in the field today. This man has not only produced this film, but has been extremely active in the area of education, counseling, and lecturing on the East Coast. But of course now has a national, and I suspect because of the Navy release, international reputation. I've had an opportunity to just informally chat the last couple hours, and I'm already stimulated by this man's vibrance. Without further ado, I would like to introduce Father Joe Martin.
Ladies and gentlemen, good afternoon. I would begin by sharing with you something that came my way about 28 years ago. I always tell people that I have a magnificent memory, but that it is short, and that's true. But there was an old bishop one time who suffered the same malady. He was at this given moment in his life about 90 years old. And he had had a horrible memory for names all his life. And the gimmick that he used to get over that, wherever he had to go and remember names, quite simply, he'd write them out on a piece of paper and pin them inside of his jacket here. And whenever he had to remember a name, he'd consult this thing. And, of course, he was known for this.
Oh, hello there, Mrs. Brennan, how are you?
And everybody get a little chuckle out of that. Well, at one time, he was asked to speak at the Golden Jubilee of a priest he himself had ordained 50 years before, and the man had been his personal secretary for 27 years. Well, they got this old man in the auditorium, and they propped him up against the podium, and he said,
"Oh, it's a lovely privilege to be here and to share with this man his happy occasion. I want to congratulate Father Eddie O'Brien on his 50 years as a priest. I'd also like to congratulate his curate over there, who has been like a son to me for these 25. Oh, Father John Desmond. And I want to wish them both many more long and fruitful years in the vineyard of our divine Lord and Master, Jesus Christ."
Now, that, of course, that's a pretty short memory. My name is Father Martin, as you know, and I am an alcoholic, as perhaps you did not know. But you'd either have to be deaf or a moron if you've seen that film not to draw that conclusion yourself. I would like to begin by giving you my idea of what the alcoholic is. I know that I fit the description, and perhaps some of you did. Some years ago, an Alitalia airship took off from LaGuardia Airport in New York, headed for Rome. and the plane was airborne for about an hour when the intercom came on, and you heard the voice. "Hello," I said, "this is your pilot." In a few minutes, it said, "The pretty stewardess, she's going to come and give you lunch, and we hope that you enjoy. But it'll be for lunch. I'm got two announcements to make. One's a good news, or one's a bad news. I'm going to give you the bad news first. Announcement number one, you're lost." He said, "I ain't got the faintest idea where we could have been. But hold on," he said. "Now, for the good news, announcement number two," he said, "we're making a damn good time." In my book, the alcoholic hasn't the vaguest notion of where he's going, but he's getting there quick. About 10 years ago, I learned one of many lessons that I've learned in my life from a lawyer friend of mine in my home group. He's a very sick man today. He's suffered a stroke. He got up at our home group. He was asked to give a talk, and it was his first. And it was a great privilege indeed to have heard him. But he began by saying, "When I was asked to talk tonight, I bluntly and quickly refused. And when I was asked why, he said, because I was petrified of the idea. He said, knowing what it's like to be on the listening end, I knew the unutterable responsibility of the speaker. And he said, I was not about to take that up just yet. Because when I speak at an AA meeting, I'm playing with your lives." And then someone persuaded him to talk anyway, and he gave a magnificent, brilliant talk. My friends, we are asked in AA to tell, quotes, our story. What I was like, what happened, and what I am like now. And, you know, judging other people is one of our favorite indoor sports. It's one of mine, anyways. And I have taken to this practice. I believe it valid to say that if you want to know the state of one's sobriety, listen to him talk. Clock sometime the length of time that a recovered alcoholic dedicates to the sick years, and the length of time in his talk that he dedicates to his well years, and you'll find out where his mind and heart reside. I remember one time when I first came into AA, going to a meeting in Michigan, down near Royal Oak. It was one of the la-di-da groups, and it was a 42-year-old novelist talking. He repeated drinking bouts and whole conversations, 3-day chunks of his life without missing a syllable. At the end of 1 hour and 10 minutes, he had reached age 35. For all I know, he's still talking. And so I came to adopt this as a principle in my own life. When I tell you what it was like, I will use only those incidents that serve to remind me that I am an alcoholic and perhaps to help you identify, if you can identify with no other. In other words, when I speak at an AA meeting, I say nothing without a purpose. My drinking, by the way, was very unspectacular, and if you have come from afar to hear the lurid details of my life, you may as well go on home now to work now. I taught for 20 years. I never once showed up in a classroom in my shorts. I never once roller skated down the middle aisle of a church. There is nothing spectacular about my drinking at all. But I'll tell you a few things about my drinking that will let you know that it wasn't too normal. Well, I was ordained in 1948 in May, and the following September I arrived in Mountain View down there near Los Altos, and I taught there for 7 years. So this is like coming home's first time back in 17 years. And they assigned me to teach Greek. Well, God, I figure anybody that teaches Greek's got to drink. It was Greek and English and history and religion, a few other subjects over the years, but nonetheless. It is not natural, however, to give the students an assignment halfway through class after you've heard the day's translations and then go up to your room for a couple of double shots of gin and come down and wait for class to end. I couldn't see then that that wasn't too normal. There were some good times in my drinking. I drank for 10 years from age 24 to age 34, and the progression of my disease was very gradual and very slow indeed. In fact, I used to say that I drank 5 years in a social way and 5 years in a slowly progressive alcoholic or addictive way. But as I got weller and soberer, it got to be 4 and 6. A couple more years went by, and then it was 3 and 7. It's down to about 1 and 9 now, because I could see in the beginning some of the signs that we're so familiar with. One great problem that many alcoholics have had, now get this, let's take a 45-year-old man or woman, completely competent, they've raised a family, own a business, built a house, own a couple of cars. One of the gravest problems in the lives of many alcoholics is how to get rid of empty bottles. Fair enough. It's a perplexing, major problem of life. I've heard people say they wrap the bloody things up in Christmas paper and put them in so that the garbage man wouldn't know. What's he care? I had no problem getting rid of empties at all. I never even gave it a second thought. I had a nice, big, beautiful walk-in closet, and in there I had 2 suitcases that I used only for empty bottles. One was tan, kind of a buckskin, one was black. And when I got them both filled, I then proceeded to empty them. They would hold perhaps, 35, 40 bottles, both of them. But what never dawned on me was this. Down there at St. Joe's, there's a big barn, and behind it is a dump. And I used to take the bottles down there and toss them. But I used to wait until the kids would be in class. They'd all be in the classrooms, and then I'd take off. Now, the barn is way down in the back, see? You have to cross by the tennis courts, the swimming pool, the ball fields, and so on, way, way down. It never occurred to me that all those kids would have to do would be just to glance out of a classroom window, and there they'd see Mrs. Martin's little boy heading for the hills with a flowing cassock on and 2 suitcases in my hands. Never dawned on me that would look a little bit odd. I think I can say quite honestly I had only one true consolation about my drinking years. I'd get down behind that barn and I'd bury those dead soldiers one at a time. I'd fire them onto the heap of tin cans, one at a time, 35 of them. And I would smile as I did so because I was consoled by the fact that every one of those dead soldiers had a priest with him when he died. Everyone. But this should have been an indication. I went home one summer and I was doing some pretty good drinking. I stayed at the seminary where I studied back in Baltimore. There's no one around, 5 or 6 men on the faculty who lived there. Now, I remember one night coming back from my sister's. I had a nearly full 5th bottle of Canadian Club. I was walking to my room up on the 4th floor along the corridor, and that rascal slipped right through my arm and crashed on a terrazzo floor. I damn near cried. You know, there's this loss. You can't get it back. Normal people would probably have been a little chagrined at the loss of the money. I was chagrined at the loss of the whiskey. My drinking got bad. My mind became more and more preoccupied with it. And my nerves became quite shot. And I was hospitalized in St. Mary's Hospital in San Francisco. And I was in the care of, I don't mean this to be a pun, he was a very wise man and a good physician. His name was Dr. Solomon. I don't know if he's still there or not. A very gentle and compassionate man. But he knew little, very little about alcoholism. But he had the great good sense to admit it. You know, this should have given me a little indication. I was so bad the day I went to the hospital, I was shaking to pieces. Now, every day of my life, with rare exception, every day of my life, I cut myself shaving. I have a little nephew whose dad died when he was 3. And I used to love to bring John to the seminary with me to stay overnight. You know, his mother would let him come. Because John's great joy was to come into the bathroom with me in the morning, and he'd pull the toilet seat down, hop up on it, and watch me bleed. He thought that was great. Watching his uncle shave and bleed. Now, that's neither here nor there. I simply mentioned that I usually cut myself every day when I shave. Into each life some rain should fall. Anyway, the day I left to go to St. Mary's Hospital in San Francisco, I cut myself shaving. There's nothing extraordinary about that at all. But I cut myself with an electric razor. I don't think normal people do that. I spent 3 weeks in that hospital, and never once was the word alcoholism used. Never once. The following summer, when I went back east, I found out from my sister that she had written to the boss and said, "What's the matter with him? Why is he in the hospital?" She got a reply, "He is suffering from acute alcoholism." My Lord, I nearly fell off the Christmas tree. I got out of the hospital, and Father Larry Taylor, my dearest priest friend, came up to get me. And we went immediately from St. Mary's to one of the fine San Francisco restaurants. I had 2 double martinis and dinner, and it never dawned on me that I shouldn't have had them. Never dawned on me. 2 weeks later, I was in a horrible pickle again, and they shipped me back east. To St. Charles, another prep seminary like St. Joseph's, where I spent the 2 most miserable years of my life. 2 things, I think, should be of significance. Number one, I tried to stop drinking and could not. And every one of us knows that terror. I tried to stop drinking and could not. I'd go for 5 or 6 weeks. And then on the way home from my sister's, I'd have the cab stop and I'd get a bottle of whiskey. I didn't know why. I know why now, because I've learned that alcoholics drink simply because they can't not drink. We don't need a whole lot of background psychological barnyard sauce. We drink because we can't not drink. That's the nature of our disease. And the second thing is this, and I think it highly significant for anyone in this room who has any doubts about his alcoholism. Answer one question. Have you ever lied about your drinking? If your answer is yes, you're in. Do you know why? The human mind, my friends, is not a garbage dump. It was made for truth. And the behaviorists can write books about we learn truth from our parents. That's nonsense. It's an instinct built in by God Almighty. The human mind was made for truth, just like those little cups were made to hold liquid. And the chairs you're sitting on were made to be sat on. The human mind was made to ferret out what is so. The alcoholic is not a liar by nature. He's a liar because his disease makes him lie and prostitute the very prime faculty that God has given man, his intellect. I never lied much about my drinking. I wasn't asked much about my drinking. But I can remember one incident. The big boss called me in shortly before Christmas, my 2nd year at St. Charles. And he called to tell me he was putting me in the hospital over the Christmas holidays so I wouldn't get into any trouble. But this is the way he began. He called on the 18th. My great hang-up throughout all of life is fear of authority. I'd see a boss coming down one side of the corridor, I'd be on the other. He called on the 18th of December, and the Christmas vacation began on the 20th, and I shook to pieces for 2 days. We all know that feeling. Have you ever held your breath for 6 floors on an elevator, terrified that somebody might smell you've been drinking? My God, normal people don't do that. Anyway, that's the way I felt before I walked into his office. And I walked in, he said, good morning. I said, hello, Father. He said, let's quit pussyfooting around. Have you been drinking? I said, no, Father. Now, I knew I was lying. He knew I was lying. I knew that he knew I was lying. And yes would not come out of my mouth. Yes would not come out of my mouth. I was afraid of everything and everybody. We all know, I think, what it is like to lie on our backs in a bed and stare at the ceiling and shake. Despair is one thing written on the pages of a theology textbook, and it's another to experience in the pit of your guts. The alcoholic is alone, but he is not just alone. He is alone and unhappy about it. He is alone and frustrated. He is alone and lonely. And if you're lucky, as I was, you contract another disease. It is called soul sickness. And you know you have it when you try the mirror test. It's when you look into a mirror and experience an overwhelming desire to puke. That's soul sickness. Well, Father McDonald came to see me in May of that year and said, we are sending you away to a place where we hope you'll get well. 90% of my problem was gone. It is bad, I think, to draw generalizations about the alcoholic from one's own experience, because there are alcoholics who are different from me. Yes, we lie, but there are other times when we don't. I've heard alcoholics say, I tried religion and it didn't work, and I tried psychiatry and it didn't work, and I tried medicine and it didn't work, and I tried psychology and it didn't work. I have yet to hear anybody say, I tried them all and I didn't work. I didn't, you see. I went to a psychiatrist and told him the truth and continued to drink. But you see, I was using the wrong means. I was using a milk bottle to try to drive nails with, and milk bottles weren't made to drive nails with, hammers were. And this is where the human animal has spun his wheels in the wrong direction for centuries, trying the wrong medicine for the illness. But I went to a place called Guest House in Lake Orion, Michigan. These were an experience that was getting there. One of our men, we have a seminary in Detroit, used to, we got kicked out of it. But anyway, the rector there, Father Lyman Fenn, who had taught me, was given permission by the guest house people to meet me at the airport so there'd be somebody I knew, and he was to drive me out there. So we got on M-24, straight north from Detroit, up toward Pontiac. And then we came, as we headed toward Lake Orion, to a little road called Scripps Road. And he turned on to it, and it was a dirt road. And it went on, and the houses got sparser and more rare. I don't think, what in the name of God is this man taking me? He was telling me all about how wonderful Guest House was and how it worked, and God, we're going farther and farther into the wilderness. Till we came to a set of railroad tracks and crossed them, and then there burst on the scene one of the most magnificent sights I've ever seen in my life, Guest House itself. It was the former Scripps estate, built at a cost of $2.5 million in the 1920s. A house of great peace, and a house in which I trust I recovered my health. I was introduced to the man who runs it, who brought it into being, Austin Ripley, and having been with him about 10 minutes, I felt closer to him than I had ever felt to any human being in my life. He knew what was inside of me, and instinct told me he would make it better. My friends, the 12 principles of AA as such did not save me. I could have read them on a piece of paper in my room and died drunk. It was the way a man lived them that saved me. A man saved me, a person. I wanted everything he had. I wanted to be just like him. I'd have spent my life trying to please him. If he had told me to jump off the roof, I'd have tried. And so he explained that AA was the therapy for alcoholism. And the following night, I went to my first meeting in Pontiac. It was quite an experience and a beautiful one. It was more a feeling than anything else. Hope was born. I knew that one could get sober because I was looking at it in other people. And basically and bluntly, this is what AA said to me and what it says to you. Leave your brains right outside the door. That was the finest piece of advice Rip ever gave me. He said, I know all about your education, your background, and your degrees. They didn't help, did they? I said, no. He said, leave your brains right outside the door. If you want what we've got, then you do what we did. It is just that simple. Action, not activity, action arising from the heart. Action is the magic word. Do, and then talk. Well, you know, have you ever heard this simple little thing? I found it helpful. I just wonder, when the good God created us with two ears and one mouth, I wonder if he wasn't trying to tell us something. And so we were taught there to listen. I could go on at great length telling you about Guest House and the philosophy behind it, what brought it into being and the type of care that is given. I will simply tell you this. Rip learned from Bill Wilson a basic premise about this illness. The good is too often the enemy of the best. If your mother had cancer and were dying of it, you'd see that she got the best of care. That's not done for the alcoholic. What's good enough is good enough. Rip's ideals were way up there. We need the best, we want it, and we will get it. But you see, you get nothing for nothing and damn little for 2 cents in this life, so if you want the best, you pay for it, and he was willing to pay the price. Proof of any pudding is in the eating. It works. I was the 88th priest to go through Guest House, and to date, they have made well and put back where they belong 1,150 priests. This is unheard of in the history of mankind. It works. And Rip used to take us in tiny little groups of two and three, and he explained the steps of AA. I would like to share with you what the past 15 years of my life have meant, and I would like to share with you how I have tried to get more and more sober and to get more and more well. I would like to tell you what these steps, these principles by which we live, mean to me, how I look at them, and for some at least, how I try to work them. The first step is the base of the pyramid on which we build the new life. I am not about to take on me the self-surgery that is implied in our program unless I see the need for it. And so I have come to realize this. The depth and the seriousness with which I try to work steps 2 to 12 inclusive depend directly on the depth and the seriousness with which I take step 1. My own idea is this. Number 1 is not just a step that I get on and go on to something else. Number 1 to me is an awareness of what I am. My friends, there is a vast difference between intellectually saying, yes, I am an alcoholic, and from down here saying, I am an alcoholic. I am. And every day of my life, I try to deepen that awareness. I can't drink. I don't know about you. I can't drink. I happen to be an alcoholic. A realization of my condition, because if I don't realize it, I'm dead. And I'd like to share something else with you here. I am afraid of alcohol. I fear it. But in AA, I have discovered this. We are scared to death to use the word fear. And so you hear such things as, well, no, I'm not afraid of it. I respect it. Good God. To me, respect means I hold something in high esteem. I admire it. I admire people and I admire principles. But for me to say that I respect alcohol is like listening to a little kid say, gee whiz, I respect my roller skates. I don't know how we can respect an inanimate object. But you see, being afraid to use the word fear, I think I should be without it once I get sober. I don't use the word. What's the matter with fear? We all should have very healthy fear. I'm not scared to death of it in the sense that I tremble before it or I'm afraid to be around it. But I can tell you this bluntly for myself. If I am not afraid that drinking alcohol is going to kill me, I'm going to drink it. Yes, I'm scared of it, but I hope to God it is a sane, healthy fear, just as walking on a tightrope over Niagara Falls would be a healthy fear for me. And if I were walking by Flyshacker Zoo and a leopard got loose, I'd be scared to death. There are some fears that are very healthy indeed. If I have none, I'm crazy. Well, anyhow, step one says we admitted we were powerless over alcohol. The word powerless is an absolute. There's no relativity in it all. None. No power at all. God, do you know what that means, that admission? Alcohol is a liquid, right? You remember your first year high school science classes? You know what alcohol, or what a liquid, any liquid is by definition? It's a substance that takes the shape of its container. Put it in a round bottle, it's round. Put it in a square carton, it's square. Put it in an ashtray, it's oval. Spill on the floor, it's all over. It has no shape. It can neither speak, hear, smell, taste, or touch. And yet it controlled my life. It controlled my life. It dictated the restaurants I went to down the bay. It dictated the people I associated with. And it occupied about 90% of my conscious thought. If you're an alcoholic, you look back on the drinking and see if your mind is not preoccupied with alcohol. It just is. And this, to me, is the unmanageability of life. I used the expression before, and I still do. To me, one definition of alcoholism, the prostitution of the noblest faculty God gave man, his mind. My mind was not free to think. It was controlled by thoughts of alcohol. Stated very bluntly, give in, or you'll cave in. To me, the alcoholic is the man or woman or youngster who gets up every morning of his life and climbs into a boxing ring and gets creamed. Next morning, gets up, climbs into the ring, gets creamed again. He says, geez, I ache, you know. How can I not get hurt? You know, and he keeps us up for like 19 years. Gets in a ring, gets beat up. Well, now he's pretty battered. And he gets out of bed one morning and hardly moves. You know, he says, my God, I'm black and blue. How can I keep from getting beat up today? And somebody comes along and says, don't get in the ring. That's a little bit too simple. That's a little bit too simple. Now, my God, give me something complicated. I'll buy that, but don't tell me to not drink. And yet, you know, the simplest statement on the face of the earth, and you don't have to have a PhD to grasp this. I don't know who it was first said it. It may have been Hannibal speaking to the troops before they moved the elephants over the Alps. Gentlemen, if you don't take a drink, you can't get drunk. It can't be done. But how do I not drink? How do I not drink? See, that's the problem. I want to not get in that ring and get killed, but I'm just compelled to get in there. I'm compelled to drink again, and yet I know that every time I fight alcohol, I lose. Every time I fight it, I lose. And so they ushered me into a room full of people who admitted the same thing, only they weren't climbing in the ring. They were sober. This man, 4 years. This lady, 10. This man, 12. This woman, 16. And I look at them and say, how'd you do it? They said, well, just like you, we're powerless over it. We don't have it. We came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us.
Oh. How simple, my God.
By the way, if you don't think there's a power bigger than you, try the mirror treatment. Look in one. And if you can't come to the conclusion that somewhere, someplace, there's got to be something bigger than what you're looking at, you are sick. You know, Bill Wilson put the word God in that step, and he got crucified. Get that out of there. That was the most providential thing that ever happened. Because those of us in AA know what alcohol has reduced us to. We know what we did to our consciences. Face it, half of us in this room had to drink to do some of the things we wanted to and couldn't sober. We're so scared to death of God, our preconceived misconception of him, that many of us just say that he isn't. Well, you know, we can take care of this fear, too, a little later on. All I have to do is look at somebody, say, well, face it, if you're going to buy a Cadillac, you don't go to a VW owner and ask about performance. Now, if you want to know sobriety, ask the man that's got one. Say, what'd you do? He says, well, I just came to believe that it could be done because I saw it being done. And if the power ain't in me, it's got to come from outside of me. This restoration to sanity is a corker. I don't know whether I did it in that film or not. But I would like to spend just a little bit of time because I know that this word sanity is a great stumbling block for many alcoholics. I met Bill Wilson once. I had the privilege of meeting that man and touching him. And I heard him explain sanity. I've heard AA guys and gals get up and waste a whole hour saying all the nutty things they did when they were drinking and say, now that was insane. It's not insane at all. It's perfectly normal drugged behavior. Drink enough, you'll do anything nutty. The alcoholic who is physically sober and takes the first drink of the next series, that's insane. Now, insane, that's a pretty harsh word until we understand what it means. The ancients in Greece and Rome had an expression to describe the ideal human being, a sound mind and a sound body. And the Latin word for sound is S-A-N-U-S, sanus, mens sana. Incorpore sano. Now, they cultivated the body by athletics. We still have the Olympic Games with us. And they cultivated the mind, the spirit, the anima, the soul, by a pursuit of truth. And the love of truth, the Greek word is philosophy, love of truth. A sound mind is a healthy mind. We get the word sanitation from it, physical health. And sanity, mental health. What do you mean by mental health? Functioning according to reason. That's all. For a man or woman to drink a chemical that's going to kill him is unreasonable. But the biochemical addiction in our body forces us to act against reason. You know what AA does? It stops the drinking. And it gets the I back over the E, and we function as reasonable people again. We don't drink. That's all that second step means. We came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore reason or sanity in our lives so that we can govern ourselves by reason rather than the forces of our addiction or the crazy obsession of our minds that made us drink alcohol. Well, all right, I can't handle it. I have come to believe that some power bigger than me can. Now, what do? I get in touch. We made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood him. Not my God, not your God, but God as I understand him and God as you understand him. I would, if I may, share a thought about turning things over to God, because here's a new AA. He's still all fogged up here, and somebody says, let go and let God. And he looks up and says, let God what? You know, we have to understand these glib phrases we talk around or about. You do not just sit in a chair and say, all right, God, give me about 38 pounds of sobriety. It doesn't happen that way. And I have found it helpful, a little illustration. There's a kid one time who was afraid of the dark. He lived on a farm. The evening paper hadn't been brought in that evening. Somebody goofed and forgot. So the mother, after supper, it's about 7:30 now, said, go out and get the paper. The mailbox about 50 yards in front of the house down the path. Pitch dark outside. No moon, no stars, no nothing. This kid's scared to death. So he drags his feet until finally the mother says, you go out and get that paper. And he starts to cry. She says, what's wrong? He says, finally, he admits, I'm afraid of the dark. She said, well, now, don't be. God's out there. He's everywhere. There's nothing to be afraid of. So the kid went to the door, opened it, stuck his arm out, and asked God to hand the newspaper. God does not work that way. He just doesn't work that way. He gives us the means to not drink. We have to use them. What are the means? The rest of these steps. God, it is so simple. When all else fails, follow directions. They work. They work. Just do them. That's all. God's will for me is the rest of these steps. I'll get the job done. All right, I can't handle it. God can. I believe I'll let him. The old maxim, and it goes back centuries, you pray as if it all depended on God, but you work as if it all depended on you, and the combination usually works out. Now we come to the guts of AA, the steps that separate the men from the boys and the big girls from the little girls. And ladies and gentlemen, Rip told us this before we left the house. Fathers, when you get up at an AA meeting, don't you talk about anything that you have not yet done yourself or are willing to do. Step 4, we made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. Now, searching and fearless should tell us something. An inventory is obvious. We look at what is there. The good has usually been shrouded over by the bad, and there isn't much good left. But there's the person loaded down with phony humility who keeps saying, I was a nothing and I am a nothing. Oh, that claptrap, good God. He doesn't believe that any more than anything. If he did, he'd let his wife tell his drinking part and he'd tell the... We're not about to let that happen. Let me get up here and condemn myself because I don't believe it and I don't want you to believe it. But the man who says he was a nothing is either a liar or a fool. My friends, God Almighty never made a nothing. Every one of us in this room has a talent that no one else has. And there will be people who can't put two sentences together who can save lives that I'll never even get near and couldn't touch, couldn't budge. There's a man back in Baltimore. He got well, oddly enough, through the public inebriate program. Program brought into being to give Skid Row derelicts a place to die with dignity. There's no thought of getting them sober. He got sober. This man never enjoyed more than 6 days consecutive of sobriety in his entire adult life. He's now sober 3 years. He'll save people that I couldn't touch. Each of us has a talent of his own. And we take the inventory not just to find out what's bad, but to find out what we have to build on, because we're going to have to do a lot of powerful building. But the idea is to ferret out of my life what does not belong. And so we admitted to God, to ourselves, and another human being exact nature of our wrongs. This is the big one. Every one of us is three. I am who I think I am. I am who you think I am. And they're both way off target. And then there's the real me. And the real me is only going to come to light through strong, fearless, searching inventory taking. I've been at meetings where these two steps, my God, in some areas in the United States, the steps aren't discussed at all. But I'll pass on to you what happened at my home group. We were talking about steps 4 and 5 one night, the admission to God, to self, and to another alcoholic. Well, it's the easiest thing in the world to admit something to God. He knows it anyway. But to admit it to myself, I'm not too sure I want to. But to another human being? Answer me a simple one. Which of you in this room would want any given 24-hour period of your life shown to the rest of us on a screen up here? I mean everything, every thought, every feeling, every word, every act. Good God, I wouldn't want you to see my best day up here. I wouldn't. I'm dead serious about that. I wouldn't. And now I have to bear everything that is me to another human being? Yes. That is, if I want the AA that Bill Wilson talks about. God, I've heard 1,000 interpretations of that step. The steps aren't to be interpreted, they're to be done. I was told, as suggested in the big book, write it out so you could see what the bottle had done to you. And I looked and I nearly died. And I took my fifth step to a layman. It was the single most difficult, most humiliating thing I have ever done in my life. And as Rip says, nobody gets up in front of you and tries to persuade you of the reasonableness of doing it. Ladies and gentlemen, you do it because it ought to be done. Its value will come to you only after you have done it. I discovered that. Rip promised that. He said it. And I found it to be true. Let's talk about guilt, you and I. It's necessary. I do not go along with the school of psychiatry that says guilt should go. Guilt is a very real phenomenon of the human animal. When he breaks a law, he should feel it. The guilt complex, unbalanced guilt, this thing that we call remorse, that has to go. And I'll tell you this, that the fifth step is there for a purpose. If I don't resolve my guilt feelings, they will ultimately dissolve me. I have seen it. Seen people sober 5, 6, 7, 15, 16, 17 years, and they'll come and discuss by the hour, where do you get serenity? I'm still miserable. You can see it, you can hear it, you can feel it. And I think the basic reason is they have not resolved that which they feel is too difficult. If there are those of you in this room who have not yet taken steps 4 and 5, I believe that's because we're just too scared to. Face it, I don't like pain, and that is too painful. And so I'm going to rationalize my way out of it. Let's go back to the meeting. I was at my home group. We got talking about steps 4 and 5, and I heard all kinds of pussyfooting about it. Well, I consider that what I say at this table constitutes my fifth step. You know, as the years go by, I let it all go out. And a good friend of mine, and by the way, he was a professional cusser. He's one of the best cussers I ever heard in my life. Most people that cuss are crude, really, but I admire a good one. And he was a pro. He really was. But I know this. When this man spoke, I listened. And he said, it's what I don't dare say at these tables that constitutes my fifth step. My friends, alcoholism is not a pretty disease at all. It rendered every single one of us bankrupt in every single department of our lives, including our moral lives, to such a degree that the step reads, we took a searching and fearless moral inventory of our lives. When you hear the word moral, you think of the will, the chooser. But I know this, and Rip, with that golden tongue of his, used to say, once the steps are done, my past is discharged, my present secure, and my future is assured. Now we start the painful, painful process of rebuilding. You know that the minimum stay at Guest House was 3 months? I was there 7. Some are indeed much sicker than others. But watch now the magnificent knowledge of human beings that this program evinces. We, you and I, have functioned on feelings all our lives. Now we're told to function according to reason. Now we prepare and then execute, we prepare and then execute, we prepare and then execute. I admit the problem first before doing something about it. I make a decision to turn my will and my life over to God, and then I try to fulfill that every day. I make an inventory of myself so that what I bear to God, self, and another is complete and done once and for all. Now I'm asked to become willing to have God remove my defects of character. And face it, if you're like me, your defects have character. And then I ask him to do it. We prepare, then we execute. We humbly ask him to remove our shortcomings. And I will only offer this because I have found it in my life. If you don't want them removed, don't ask. Because if you ask, he'll try. God just doesn't simply make us patient if impatience is one of our defects of character. What he does is provide us opportunities for becoming patient. Did you ever hear a guy tear into an AA meeting and I said, oh, geez, did I need this meeting? I had a flat on the way to work on the freeway. I get in there and have a fight with the secretary. I get bawled out by the boss. I come home. She's in a horrible mood, burned to supper. I just made it here. God, do I need this? A horrible, horrible day. And the true AA with deep spiritual insight says one of the best days of your life. God gave you about 14 opportunities to grow and you blew them all. We will advance in patience by how we handle opportunities to be impatient. And now the biggies. Either the wife or the husband has been covering up for the alcoholic all along. Now we're asked to make a list of persons we had harmed and become willing to make amends to them all. That's the preparation, the list. Then we made direct amends to such persons whenever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. Boy, I've heard some beautiful interpretations of these things, too. By the way, many of us lightly dismiss things that we don't remember. The step doesn't say we made a list of all persons we had knowingly harmed or willingly harmed. It simply says we made a list of people that we harmed. You don't have to be morally guilty here. You just have to see if damage is done, you owe an amend. Every act against the law we perform has two elements in it, guilt and punishment. I would dwell on these two steps because I feel them to be important. I feel that they are important in resolving the discontent in our lives. I've got to wipe the slate clean. And if a lot of my past garbage remains, it's going to chew away at me until and unless it dissolves me. A little kid goes out in his backyard with a ball bat and a ball, and he begins hitting it to a buddy at the end of the yard. It's a windy day, and the wind keeps carrying the ball. He keeps hitting it until finally he hits a high one, and the wind brings it right through the window of a neighbor. And he goes over and he knocks on the door, and he says, "Mrs. Jackson, I apologize. That was me who did that." She says, "You're forgiven. The guilt is wiped out." That'll be $5.98. You ever been to an AA meeting where they have a real pro speaker? He's building up to this crescendo. This is what I mean by having a real purpose in saying what you do about your drinking instead of just getting there trying to wring tears out of people. He's building up to this by telling you how his drinking dragged him down and down. And of course, he's got all of our sympathies, you know, leaning forward until he says, "Finally, I hit the depths. How low can you get? On the last drunk, and this is what did it. It finally brought me to AA. I actually stole pennies from my little 5-year-old daughter's piggy bank. And God, we're sitting there in tears, you and I. What a magnificent, humble man to bear his soul to us. I want to hear some bitch tell me put it back." Do you see what I'm after? Don't just tell me how sick you were. Tell me how well you got, that I might get well too. Every one of us has an amend to make that is impossible, and so we shy away from it. I have heard fellas in AA say, "God, I'll never be able to do this." Ladies and gentlemen, there's always somebody that's done it before you. Always. And they're around, and you can find out how and when to do these things. Some of them are tough. My Lord, I made one amend after I was sober 8 years. We went down to a guy's house. His wife was in the hospital. He couldn't make meetings, so we went to the house. We got talking about amends one night, and it dawned on me. I used to help out in a parish right next to the school where I taught back in Baltimore. And after the last mass every Sunday, I'd drink a water glass full of this guy's wine. I must have drunk a case of that man's wine. And I said, "You know, I've never done anything about that." So I ran out a check for a case of wine. I get down one Saturday. I'm sober about 8 years now. And we were great and good friends. But this man, by the way, this was the clincher of my alcoholism. He made a request of my superior that I be removed from his parish. So I went down, rang the doorbell. I said, "Hi, John, I owe you this." He said, "What for?" And I explained it to him, and the man turned beet red with embarrassment. He said, "I don't want that." And then I told him what I had, well, what subsequently I saw in the movie Days of Wine and Roses. "You don't have to take this, but I have to give it. Now you use it for whatever you want." But I would pass this on for you because I think it to be dreadfully important as to the motives with which we should do things. Have you ever been to an AA meeting and said, "Well, these amends are just a little too difficult," and you are told, "Do them, it'll make you feel good"? You don't know how good you'll feel after you do this. That's not the motive for which we've been functioning on emotion all of our drinking lives. I'll tell you what I mean with an example. Rip was a professional writer, and he used to write a feature article for Look magazine. He caused untold misery and agony with everybody in that whole corporation. And when he got sober, he flew from Chicago to New York to the Look building, and he made appointments to apologize to everybody in there. He said, I owed him from the president down to the man that opens the front door. Well, he had a golden tongue, and he went from office to office giving his pretty little spiel about alcoholism, what it had done to him, and about how well he had got an AA, and they're all in tears, you know, and they're saying, Rip, you're great, and they patted him on the back and were just delighted you're sober. And he was getting all these cookies and feeling great about them, hopping from one office to the other till he hit one. The man made him wait for 20 minutes before he showed, you know, his secretary showed him in. And when he got into the man's office, the guy was just sitting behind a desk glowering at him, sucking on a pipe, and he didn't even invite Rip to sit down. And Rip went into his little speech, and he was standing there waiting for his little piece of pie. When the man took the pipe out of his mouth, he said, Ripley, you were an SOB then, and you're one now. Get out of my office. He was hurt, he was angry, and the typical reaction, well, to blazes with all this amends stuff, I'm going home. He pressed the button of the elevator, and he stood there waiting for it, fuming. But he had been sober long enough that this thought got to him before the elevator did. That man did not have to accept my apology. I just had to give it. Ladies and gentlemen, we do not make amends because they'll make us feel good. We make them because they ought to be made. I remember one time bawling a boy out in class, and I made him cry. This was about, I was teaching 19 years then. And when I looked up and saw him in tears, I thought, good Lord, I didn't mean to do that. So I got back to my room and I looked up the answer, and this kid was right. God, that burnt me up. Whatever it was that he said, he was right, but he did it in a smart, alecky way, so, yeah. You're bad. I picked up the telephone to call another priest who was down near the study hall there to send that boy up that I owed him an apology. And then this thought dawned on me. I bawled that kid out in class. And I owed him his apology in class. You know what I have found to be... there's one sure way to humility, and that's through humiliation. There's nothing quicker. Nothing quicker. It's like being called on for an award that you've worked for all your life, and you won out over 16 other guys, and this is your moment to shine. And the MC is on a stage like this, and there's an audience this side, and he reads out your name, and you glow. And you walk across the stage to get your plaque, and everybody's kind of giggling. You accept your award, you give your little speech, and you get off in the wings and find out your fly's open. That's a humiliation. I have found that the lessons I have learned best in life, I have learned hard. And the most difficult thing on earth for me is to accept a correction or a reprimand. But I can tell you this, number one, when I get too old to learn, I'll be too old. But number two, if you have anything to say to me, make sure you do it because you care enough to want me to be a better person. If you can't be kind, be still. I won't be listening. And so we make direct amends. They're excruciatingly difficult. I know of couples. The man's up here talking and his wife is in the first row. Gives him that. You know, when it's over, everybody's congratulating and falling all over. The wife's been sitting there for 16 years waiting to hear two words. I'm sorry. Hadn't heard them yet. And you know how we get away with that? Well, I figured that being sober is making amends. No, being sober is not making amends. I should be sober. Making amends is another thing. We continue to take inventory. We pray because it is human to pray, seeking only a knowledge of God's will for us. If I may, I would simply like to make this comment. Many people have difficulty with pursuing the spiritual life. By the way, spiritual simply means non-physical, that's all. It's developing the mind and the will through contact with God. You know, AA is not a handbook of minute to the heights spirituality. It's a listing of guidelines for basic survival. I don't pray because it's nice. I pray because I have to. I also want to, you know, we either or things to death. I don't go to AA meetings because I have to. I go because I want to. Nonsense. I go for both reasons. I still have to, whether I want to or not. But anyway, Prayer is the food of the soul. It's what keeps me lubricated properly. It's what enables me to function without frustration and tension and so forth. But what is God's will for me? God's will for the alcoholic is that he not drink. And I can go to my grave with that basic minimum. And I also know that the rest of his will for me is to take the means that he has provided to not drink, the steps of AA. But now we come to AA's crowning glory, the 12th step. Having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, we tried to carry the message to alcoholics. This is the thing that makes AA unique and different from every other discipline on the face of the earth. Bill Wilson was indeed the man who dreamed the impossible dream. He fought the unbeatable foe, bore with unbearable sorrow, and ran where the brave dared not go. But he knew if he'd only be true to his glorious quest, his heart would lie peaceful and calm when laid to his rest. The world has been better for this. One man, scorned and covered with scars, still strove with his last ounce of courage. He reached it. The unreachable star. The precious, priceless, magnificent, breathtaking gift of freedom. We call it sobriety. And he couldn't bear to hold it to himself. So he shared it with you and me, and that's why we're sober here. Men and women have asked questions about God from the time they could speak. But the most perplexing question about God is, why did he create? If God is perfect being, if he is explanatory of his own happiness, why did he make things like you and me? And the only thing we can do with any mystery is look and describe what we see. And you know what the philosophers came up with? They simply commented on what they were looking at. Goodness tends to diffuse itself. Goodness just tends to go out. That's what love is. I love you. And you look at another and say, I love you. To love is to give. We are made to go out to each other. You know what addiction does? It binds me to myself so that I am unable to fulfill the purpose for which I'm made. And we join AA and we crucify ourselves to the tree of sobriety with the twin nails AA. And every meeting you attend and every step you try to work just drives those nails deeper and deeper and opens your arms and your heart wider and wider to embrace the rest of us. He shared. He went outward, which was the purpose for which he was made. And that's why we are happy. If we do these steps, they are guarantees for happiness. But the whole thing hinges on the tiniest and biggest phenomenon on earth. We use the word constantly. We have whole meetings about it. Gratitude. I know this to be a fact. It is said if you don't go to meetings, you'll get drunk. I hate people to be told what's going to make them drunk because it terrifies new people. But anyway, if you do this, you'll get drunk. If you do that, you'll get drunk. If you do the other thing, you'll get drunk. I know people do them all. Stay sober. I wouldn't give you a nickel for their sobriety. But I can state this infallibly. If you are not grateful for your sobriety, you cannot retain it. It just can't be done. Sobriety is, or gratitude is the hinge on which sobriety swings. It's the hinge. And I would share this with you because it took me a long while to learn it. I used to hear people get up and say, well, I'm a grateful alcoholic. And I said, jeepers, I haven't even thought of gratitude in 3 weeks. I don't know whether you've ever felt that way or not, but I have. And then it dawned on me, I don't have to feel anything. I don't have to feel grateful, I got to be grateful. Bill Wilson was sober 12 years when a fit of depression hit him and it lasted for 5. He felt nothing but misery for 5 years. But he did the job. I don't have to feel grateful, I have to be grateful. And ladies and gentlemen, you don't have to tell me you're a grateful alcoholic. If you are, I'll know it. Because I'll be looking at it. People have to crow about their virtue, just, I don't know. 10 lepers were cured by the good Lord 10 of them felt grateful. You can't have a disease lifted without feeling anything. But one of them did something about it. There's the difference that I'm talking about. I know men who have gotten up and spent a half hour talking about gratitude and go home, get a 12-step call, and refuse to take it. Talk to anybody on answering service. My God, no, don't. You'll be too disillusioned. I think that the beauty of gratitude can be seen in the ugliness of ingratitude. Everybody hates even a kid that doesn't say thanks, and it's not his fault. He's never been told. I call ingratitude the halitosis of the soul. It's the only thing that makes God Almighty turn his face away from us. But I know this. Gratitude is what makes little people big. And it's the only coin with which you can buy God. If you're grateful for today's sobriety, you just bought tomorrow's. Ladies and gentlemen, it is late in the afternoon. I have 1,000 things I'd love to share with you. I just can't now. Someday, if you have me back, I will. But I cannot leave you without bearing one final fact about my life. I know that since many of you became sober, things have gotten better. And I know that great wealth is represented here. But I can tell you that I'm the richest man in this room. God Almighty, through AA, in his goodness, has given me all of you.